Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams. Daniel, good to see you.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
Doing fine, good. All set to go, and yes. We have a special guest today.
So, we do, yes.
And that's going to be very nice, and I want to go ahead and introduce the guest. It's Jim Jatras, and he's somebody we've known and been friends with, and he's an expert on foreign policy. At least he's going to straighten us out if we go astray and tell us what the, maybe he'll straighten us our understanding of Donald Trump, and then we'll be all happy. But he's worked in international relations. He's been an advisor to the Republicans. He tried real hard in the Senate. He was an advisor there, and he did his very best. And he's also been in the U.S. Foreign Services. Jim, welcome to our program today.
Thank you, Dr. Paul. It's an honor. It's not often I have a chance to chat with a national treasure.
Oh, my
So
goodness.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, my. You don't need to say that kind of thing. But okay, it's all right.
Well, it's true, too.
The president is going to release something, I believe, on Monday, National Security Strategy, a paper. And he's supposed to help us, guide us, what to expect, where he's coming from, where he's going. What are your expectations on this? Do you think that all of a sudden we're going to be a lot more knowledgeable by Monday evening than we are today?
No, not really. My first alert on this was seeing a piece by James Carafano from the Heritage Foundation praising the thing, which, of course, it led me to expect the worst, that at least from the summary he gave, it's all the usual enemies list, Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, et cetera, written by, one would expect, the standard apparatchiki from previous Republican administrations. I suppose that the good news there is that you also see some grousing and carping from some of the usual suspects, that it doesn't go as far as some of them would like, that it's less expansive in its rhetoric about transforming the world and promoting democracy and all that sort of thing you would expect from a bunch of Bush people. And even that H.R. McMaster, in particular, the National Security Advisor, doesn't feel that Trump is really quite with the program. He isn't saying all the right things. So I suppose there's a tiny little silver lining, but my expectations are quite low overall.
Very, very good. Daniel.
You know, Jim, when we were talking before the show, you said something that I have to confess to, too. You said you hope that there's a little candidate Trump inside President Trump struggling to get out, you know. And I think it does sneak out sometimes because he says something that drives the McMasters of the world crazy. You know, he'll put something out that sounds more realist or more nationalist. But someone else who went crazy, and we talked about this a little bit before we got started, is David Frum. You know, he's unhappy. He doesn't like the tone because it's not sufficiently globalist. It doesn't have the this crusading view that George W. Bush had, that we're going to make the world safe. It doesn't have the going it together view that Obama had, the multilateralism. So in a sense, when you irritate Frum, it does kind of make you feel a little happy, but I don't know, maybe there's not much there.
Well, Daniel, we're grasping at straws, aren't we? You know, I was a very strong Trump supporter during the campaign. I endorsed him on March 6, 2016, largely because I was afraid that if Hillary Clinton got elected, we'd be looking at World War III at some very proximate point in time, with Russia, certainly, maybe also with China. The upsetting thing is that when you hear Trump talk off script, he still seems to sound the notes he did during the campaign. We need to get along with the Russians. Those deadbeats in NATO, if they're not going to pay up, let's get out of there. We're not going to guarantee their security. That very Frum piece, he talked about how McMaster had put in an explicit reference to Article 5 in the North Atlantic Treaty, and Trump, at the last minute, omitted it from his delivered remarks. That kind of thing drives them nuts. On the other hand, you ask yourself, why are the appointees in his administration so uniformly bad? Why did he turn almost exclusively to people that agreed with nothing that he said during the campaign? And I don't have the answer to that. Maybe he figures you appoint the smartest and the best people, like you're appointing a hotel manager or something, somebody who's very successful, but you'd think you would take into account the person's documented views and whether they accord with the president's.
You know, Jim, we just had an election on Tuesday, and it was rather exasperating for anybody who wants to see a decent discourse about what's going on. But one thing it pointed out to me was you know, there's strong partisanism, this fighting and fuming and lying and demagoguing and dealing with that, and that becomes the whole issue. But when you think about it, if it had come to this issue we're talking about in foreign policy, they didn't debate that because there might not be that all much difference, you know, on what they do. And if you think about it in terms of financial support in the military-industrial complex, you know, they're not going to have this. And when a country gets into the shape that we're in today and we're bankrupt and all, they have to go looking for straws, you know. What can we fight about? But do you ever feel a little bit frustrated with the fact that we always hope the Republicans will do better, we always hope they will have better foreign policy, but unfortunately the Congress, even if you hear a difference in sentiment, it seems like it's so bipartisan and so much controlled by the military-industrial complex. And the Congress, how many votes do we get for asking for a change, you know, in our foreign policy?
Well, exactly right. I mean, look at the vote on the accession of Montenegro to NATO. We had two no votes. One was a certain Senator Paul from Kentucky, and the other one was, I believe, Bernie Sanders. Look at that that sanctions bill they imposed on President Trump to put more sanctions on Russia, North Korea, and Iran, and made it essentially an encroachment on his powers to conduct foreign affairs. With regard to Alabama, I do note that Judge Moore, one of the things that he was excoriated for was that he said that he kind of liked President Putin. And in fact, you see some of the usual suspects accusing him of being just like Donald Trump, a Russian puppet. So maybe he's not such a bad guy.
Right.
Now, Jim, you touched on something that we've hit on the show quite a few times, and it's something that I pay a lot of attention to because it's frustrating. Where does Trump look to his foreign policy experts? You know, and I had a little fantasy early on when he won that someone like Jim Jatras, who's had a full career in foreign policy and foreign affairs, could be considered an expert by so many people. Someone like Jim Jatras would get the tip. But it seems to be the same old people. There's a perception in the foreign policy community that if you're not for more of it, then you're not an expert. And it's very, very frustrating. And I see now we have sort of the we mentioned Carafano's piece, and this was in the national interest. This is the flagship of the realists. And the realists and the neocons in some ways seem to be sort of intermeshing and melding to see who's more muscular in their foreign policy.
That's right. And that's where you even get the contradictions among Trump himself. Remember, even during the campaign, he was never a doctrinaire non-interventionist. He never took that position. There was always the kind of ambivalence between his denouncing, for example, the trillions of dollars that we've wasted in the wars in the Middle East with this kind of Jacksonian muscularism. But if you put that in the context of an American national interest, what actually promotes the peace and security of the United States and to use military force if necessary for that purpose, you don't necessarily come into a conflict between those two things. Because if you look at all of these wars of choice in the Middle East, or the one we may be facing in on the Korean Peninsula, if things go terribly wrong, as they appear they might, we don't have any interests in those places. What interest do we really have in Crimea or Ukraine or the Caucasus or the Hindu Kush or any of these places where we've wasted so much blood and treasure and, let's be honest, killed so many hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions? Those are not American vital national interests. So even a Jacksonian, a muscular Jacksonian, should not want to waste resources and American political commitment in these places.
Jim, Trump's been on two sides of the principles behind NATO. And, of course, Robert Taft took a position. He didn't think NATO was a good idea a long time ago. And just give me your opinion about NATO. And if you say that, you know, we really don't need it, what would the downside be? Is there a downside if we had stuck with Trump's, some of his rhetoric during the campaign, it just ignored NATO and go our own way and just look at what is best for America?
Yeah, I think we can come up with a compromise. I think we should admit Georgia and Ukraine to NATO, and we should pull out. That would be perfect. That would be perfect for everybody. Let the Europeans handle their own security. Of course, I think it was actually rather clever of him, assuming it was just being clever rather than simply the sum of his position, to say, if you dead beats don't pay up, we're not going to defend you. Article 5 is a dead letter, because we know they're not going to pay up. They're not going to meet their 2%. Why is it that we are in NATO, or for that matter, have an alliance with Japan and South Korea, where they spend less on their defense than we do, when supposedly they're the ones who feel threatened? They don't contribute to our security at all. What, does Estonia send its crack 3-man mess kit repair crew to Afghanistan? How does that enhance American security? The fact is, these are all security consumers, assuming they face any threat at all, which certainly in Europe they don't. In the Korean Peninsula and Japan, I think that's a somewhat different situation, but it's not our problem as far as I can see.
Mm. That is a great point that we've made as well, too. If they feel so threatened, why wouldn't they spend more on defense? You know,
look. Well, look, I mean, one of the few countries in NATO that does spend more than the 2% is Greece. Is it because they're scared of the Russians? No, it's because they're scared of their NATO ally, Turkey.
That's true. Well, you know, there are four main, according to McMaster's preview, there are four main platforms of the national security strategy. And we shouldn't overplay this. This is not going to be a dramatic thing. But there are hints between the lines, you know, a different tone. But these are the four pillars. Maybe you can, comment on the defending the homeland, protecting American prosperity, sustaining peace through strength, and advancing American influence. It sounds boilerplate, but I think between the lines there's something a little different there.
Well, I think you're right, and I'm glad they put the homeland first. I don't know how this would relate to previous documents of this sort, but you sort of wonder, do they really mean it? If you look at, if you will, the concentric circles of American foreign and security policy, they don't really seem to make any sense in terms of defending the homeland. You know, you wonder why we have a Department of Homeland Security and to defend our border. Shouldn't be the Department of Defense's job to defend the homeland? Isn't that should be the first priority? Why is our entire force structure built around extending power to the far corners of the globe and having anything and everything to do but defending our own territory and our own borders? So that should be our first priority. I don't know that anything that's being proposed really relates to that fundamental first objective.
Jim, there was a report today that the administration is considering blockading North Korea, which is a big event if that happens. What are the odds of that happening? Do you think that this will be mentioned, such a thing as a blockade in the strategy report, which I rather doubt? But what do you think is going on there? Because we've had hints that maybe Tillerson wanted to have a different approach. Do you think the strategy report will help iron some of these contradictions out?
I very much doubt it, Dr. Paul. Look, if again, this relates back to the question of defending our homeland. With regard to North Korea, I would think our only one real interest is to make sure that they don't ultimately test a weapon that actually could deliver a missile that could deliver a nuclear weapon to the United States. If that should be head and shoulders our first concern, which would be excellent reason to take up the Chinese and the Russians on their double freeze proposal. What do we gain in terms of more military exercises or blockades or threats against North Korea that compares to the possibility at some point North Korea would be able to strike American territory? What do we lose in accepting such a freeze proposal? Yet they won't even discuss the possibility of doing that. All they can do is talk about making more threats and, you know, decapitation drills, with the idea that if we look threatening enough, I guess they think the Chinese will go in and solve the problem for us.
Right.
You know, going back to what McMaster's presentation earlier this week, I believe it was, this is something that is so fascinating to me. You know, the whole idea of Russiagate seems to me, at least, to be unraveling as we hear more about the FBI, what was really going on behind the scenes, insurance policy against President Trump, et cetera, et cetera. But you still have McMaster delivering a talk where I believe undermining the legitimacy of the presidency. I'm just going to, if you don't mind, if you just read a little bit of what he says about this, maybe for your reaction. He cited, according as threats to the U.S., Russian efforts to sow discord in the U.S. He called it a new generation warfare. Here's a quote. He talks about sophisticated campaigns of subversion, disinformation, and propaganda using cyber tools operating across multiple no-names that attempt to divide communities within our nation and pit them against each other and try to create crises of confidence. What does that mean, Jim?
Daniel, it's gibberish. First off, sowing discord. Yeah, if it weren't for those Ruskies, we'd all be holding hands and singing Kumbaya here in this country. What a ridiculous thought. As far as disinformation, look, back when I was a Foreign Service officer, I served on the Soviet desk, the Office of Soviet Union Affairs, including what was then called Soviet Active Measures, disinformation. And the heart of that was unattributed sources with false information that then could be peddled in the general news community. It was the original fake news. What they've now turned it against is things like RT or Sputnik or anybody, or for that matter, Zero Hedge or the Ron Paul Institute. Anybody who disagrees with the official line is now going to be posted up on Hamilton 68 as a purveyor of disinformation, although nobody can show what anybody is saying there that is actually false. It's a complete, not only a perversion, but an inversion of the truth who are the peddlers of real disinformation, which are a lot of people in the government and in the mainstream media.
Jim, we're going to. Did you have a follow-up,
no,
Daniel?
No, no,
oh,
no,
okay.
No.
We're going to have to wind this down right now, Jim. But I do have one question that I'd like to close with, and that is your opinion about empire. Do you ever use the term empire? Should that be applied to what we're doing? And if so, or even if you don't call an empire, how do we unwind this? This seems to be such a struggle. I think we all try to do that, but I just wondered about what your terms you use and whether using empire is an unfair term.
No, I don't think empire, imperium, imperialism, any of those terms are at all out of place. They certainly are. Sometimes people will say, we're not really an empire because we're not like the British or the French empires in the 19th century. We're not just trying to grab resources and so forth. No, unfortunately, I think we're more like the Soviet Empire. We're an ideological empire where it's actually a net loss to our country, our people, in terms of prosperity, in terms of security, to basically try to impose instead of peace, progress, and socialism, like the Soviet Union had, is democracy, human rights, and free markets as we define them. Maybe that is one of the slivers of hope in this document that people like Fromm are saying, where is that expansive language? Where is the great, pick up the white man's burden to go out there and civilize the rest of the globe with our enlightened values? I sometimes get the feeling, especially talking to friends who were originally from the Soviet bloc, that there's this weird inversion that's gone on where Russia in particular, but also I would say China, are more like conventional normal powers simply seeking to promote their national interests. But we're the ones that have become this bizarre kind of neo-Soviet ideological power with this great mission to foist upon the rest of mankind. If they've toned that down in this document, that is something to be thankful for.
Very good assessment, Jim. And I want to thank you once again for being with us today. And appreciate that very much. And I would
appreciate
like,
it, Dr. Paul.
Good. And I'd like to thank our audience for joining us today. And please return to the Liberty Report soon.